You're listening to DraftKings Network. You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're going in the Wayback File here, Stugatz. Back when Knicks Heat against each other was something that mattered. You lived these years. I lived these years. New book, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks, is available now. Chris Herring is the author. Thank you for joining us, Chris. I've got a lot of questions, but why write this period? You were very young during this period, so why did you decide to tackle this team in this time?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. I think, you know, after a 10-part documentary on, you know, the champions from that era and, you know, the best player maybe of all time, I think sometimes we forget how big a fascination there can be with the team that consistently kind of finishes second in eras. To this day, I think the most watched 30 for 30 is the one on the Fab Five, for starters. And, you know, obviously they were culturally relevant in a different way. But I would make the argument, and it's not something that I would really even flinch while saying, I think the Knicks changed more about the way basketball would go on to be played than any team during that era. They were not the best team. You know, they did not have the best player. We all know that. But this team was extremely relevant to the people in New York. I think the team was extremely relevant to the people in Miami for a different reason. But the league absolutely wanted to run as far away as they could from the way the Knicks were playing basketball. And, you know, I think in some ways, when you take into account how relevant they were as far as the moments that they were a part of, the, you know, the crazy game five in 94 with the OJ chase happening, the back and forth between them and MJ. You look at, you know, the stuff with Reggie Miller and Spike Lee. I describe them as kind of the Forrest Gump of that era, where they were never necessarily the team that was the focal point of what was happening, but they were always in the picture. They were always somehow tied to what was happening. And I think, you know, they were very, very culturally relevant in those years, not to mention the fact that the league changed a slew of rules because of them, because they didn't want the way they played basketball to influence everybody else. So that was why I did it.
Rank them for me and add somebody from the outside if someone is better. Top three characters in Knicks history from this time period.
Oh,
I'm going to say Oakley, Pat Riley, Anthony Mason,
Chris Childs.
Do you have a list that is different?
I'd put it in a different order. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I actually got asked this question. My literary agent at one point said, "Are you sure you want Pat Riley on the cover?" And I looked at him. I was like, "What? What kind of question?" Like, Pat Riley is the most important player, the most important person in that era, as far as I'm concerned. He only spent half of the era with the Knicks, but the other half they spent hating him for exactly the reason that he left. So Pat, to me, and he's literally mentioned on the first page, and he was a part of what they did even when he wasn't there anymore. So I think he's the central character in this book and the most important person in this book. I think, at least from an interest standpoint, I would say Anthony Mason is number two. And then after that, you know, I think Starks was really fascinating. I don't know if he was necessarily the most interesting. I mean, and not to knock him, I mean, the guy essentially has Kurt Warner's story. but you know, in basketball form, he was bagging groceries a few years before. He was on, you know, the NBA final stage. He was a guy that went to four different colleges, who played 1 year, essentially one full year of high school basketball. So, I mean, his story, you know, I feel like I'm surprised we haven't seen a Lifetime movie on his story, since we've got a full movie on Kurt Warner's story and, you know, and something like that. So I would say either him or maybe you could point to Oakley. I'm not sure which one I would take, but I'd probably lean towards Starks, quite frankly.
Kurt Warner's story, a little more gentle than John Starks telling a beat reporter, I'm going to cut Reggie Miller's dick off and make him eat it.
I'd agree with that. You probably have to, maybe that's why it's not the Lifetime movie, then why it wasn't made into
Lifetime. And Kurt won a Super Bowl. I mean, Starks went 2 of 18.
John potentially lost them a final, so you're right.
Do you have a better story on John Starks or about John Starks than telling a beat reporter, quote, I'm going to cut Reggie Miller's dick off and make him eat it, end quote?
Well, better is subjective. I've had one story on him. Pat Riley is, you know, and this is why he was a central character. There's just so many detours and random things and crazy things that he said during that era and did. One of them, and I think he later did something like this with Miami. I remember hearing a story like this from one of the Heat players I interviewed. Pat took them, whenever the team would slump, I feel like he would try to do something to try to get them out of a rut. And so, you know, they had a 4-game losing streak, which to that point in 94 was the longest skid they'd had under Pat. Pat takes them to Reno for 36 hours, kind of unannounced and unexpected. He's about to make a big lineup shift where he's going to switch out three of his starters. And so he wanted to kind of do something to soften that blow. He takes them to Reno in the middle of a West Coast trip, and he gives each of the players $500 and chips. And so John Starks, from what I was told, was the first person to blow through his $500. But John, and I go into this in depth in the book, he was someone that could never just kind of accept faltering. And so he would just kind of dig deeper and deeper and deeper until he could get out the other side. So he dug into his own pockets after he blew through the $500 in the span of an hour or two. And he eventually got to such a hot streak at the craps table that when the rest of the team was out on the bus ready to make the trip to Sacramento, they took attendance and John was the only one that was not in his seat on the bus or not on the bus at all. They were ready to leave and the team trainer, the team, you know, traveling secretary, Mike Saunders, had to go find John somewhere in the casino because he was still gambling, trying to get out of the hole or, you know, just he was on such a hot streak that he wasn't ready to leave. And that Mike Saunders told me I had to literally drag John out of the casino because we had to leave. And so that was just kind of who John was.
Will Pat Riley like the book?
I don't know. Someone from the Heat who's tied to the Heat said, first of all, Chris, this book is great. I can't stop flipping through it and can't stop reading these anecdotes. But, you know, I'm going to send you one. I want you to sign it out to Pat. And that was my first question. Are you sure Pat wants a copy of this book? You know, it tells the story, I think, very accurately. I'd certainly made every effort to get Pat for this book. I went to Pat's hometown for the better part of a week where he grew up in upstate New York in Schenectady, you know, spent time at his house where, he spent time as a child, spent a lot of time with the people from his childhood and from his playing days, college days, everything. You know, what I would say, the reason that the person that wanted me to sign a book to Pat said he thought that Pat would like it. He was like, it reads as crazy to you and it will read as crazy to most people. But I think Pat kind of knows who he is and knows that he's wound the way he's wound and that, he's different and that a lot of us can't relate with being that competitive to the point where we're going to tell our boss, no, you can't get this color car. Your wife can't buy this color car for the family because that forest green represents the Celtics and red represents the Bulls. So she has to get a blue Chevy Suburban. I can't relate with that, but Pat knows that that's how he is and that he's that in or out as it relates to loyalty and betrayal and everything else. Pat knows that he wants to get the messaging across to his players to watch Rams headbutt each other and watch car crashes in a pregame setting to get them ready to go play a really good offensive Portland team. I can't relate with that. I never needed that sort of motivation to go play hard defense. But Pat, if he needs to get that messaging across, it's all stuff that he knows more or less. And I don't think that he shies away from. So to me, I didn't think it was necessarily like the sweetest portrayal, but Pat probably doesn't really see himself as a sweet person when it relates to his coaching. But I think it's a fair portrayal and I think it's who he is. So it's funny. I don't think of it as being like the nicest portrayal, but I'm also not Pat Riley and the stuff he would be offended by is probably different than the way I would worry about offending someone with writing it.
who won't like the book? Like, you don't need to wait for a reaction. You just know because you wrote it, they're not going to like this.
Jim Dolan is probably one. And I barely even really get into it with him, but it's just the story kind of tells itself on some level. They were really great during those years. And then shortly after the book ends, they were really horrible. And I essentially let people kind of connect the dots on their own that, you know, that Jim Dolan came in and immediately made it known that he wanted to make changes. That first full season, he's involved as the owner. Basically, with 8 games to go and that 50-game season, that lockout shortened season, orders that Dave Chekins, the team president, has to fire Ernie Grunfeld with 8 games left, even though they're still in the thick of the playoff race and have a chance to make the playoffs. He makes the decision. They fire Ernie Grunfeld. They go 6-2 over those last 8 games to snag the last playoff spot. And then they went to the NBA Finals from the 8 seed. Still the only team to ever do that. They obviously knocked off Miami with that Allen Houston shot that year to do it. But the way that everybody's kind of told it to me is like, well, what do you think that had, you know, as far as impact on Dolan? It emboldened him to think that every time he pulled the lever, he was making the right move. So, you know, from that point, they essentially was a downhill slide for them after that. And very little has gone right since Patrick Ewing has left the organization. And a lot of that, I think you have to leave at Dolan's feet. I don't go into every last detail about it because I, you know, to me, it was a lot more interesting to write about the 90s when they were good and let you draw your own conclusions about what changed when they were bad. But I think it's pretty clear that Dolan was that change.
Do you chronicle Charles Oakley slapping everybody?
If not, it should be your next book.
Yeah, a lot of the slapping, man, happened after Oak left the Knicks. And there was some of it during that lockout season. But my favorite Oakley anecdote, man, I have one anecdote in there about him punching the crap out of Paul Silas when he was Oakley's coach, assistant coach with the Knicks. And and Paul Silas remembering that he had bruises and welts for like 2-3 weeks after that. But
and Silas, my favorite, Silas was not someone to be trifled with. Other people feared Silas plenty.
He was the Oakley. He was one of the Oakleys of that era, you know. So my favorite Oakley stories, I guess I would say, he had. I'm normally people see me as a numbers person, and obviously this book takes me way out of that realm. I'm not doing that in this book. But Oakley in '93, when you talk about why the Knicks were so influential in changing the rules, Oakley had more flagrant fouls by himself than 15 other teams in one season in '93, and he also had more than twice as many as any player during that year. And then that was when the league said, okay, maybe it's time for us to start putting a threshold as far as how many you can have before we suspend you. So there was that. But the thing with Oakley that makes me laugh still, he loved to gamble, and it just shouldn't be that big of a surprise. You know, he came up with Michael Jordan and those Chicago years. So he loved to gamble by the time he got to New York. He was one of the more highly paid guys on that team. So he had more money to gamble. He'd bring $50,000 in cash on each trip to bring in his leather duffel bag. But he would get really frustrated when his younger teammates that weren't earning the same amount of money would complain, you know, man, I can't join you for these high stakes games. I just don't have it. Like, I've got my per diem and that's about it. So Oak would start getting tired of that excuse. And eventually what he did by the time that the team got to about 97, and this was a story from Chris Childs. So, you know, shout out to Chris for giving me this. He said at a certain point, Oak finally just went out and he bought one of those credit card imprint machines so that guys wouldn't have an excuse that they didn't have enough cash to gamble with us anymore. So he would start having guys gamble on credit and he would essentially make them pay a 10% penalty for using his imprint machine. But that was Charles Oakley for you. He loved to gamble. He wasn't going to let anything stand in the way of him having, you know, time to gamble with his teammates on the plane.
True or false, Anthony Mason once left a note for Don Nelson, the coach, in his office that read, "If you take me out of a game again, I'll kill you."
Oh, no.
True. True. And I think that the most important part about the truth, which, you know, is enough on its own, Anthony Mason was leading the league in minutes that season. So it wasn't as if, you know, Don Nelson had an axe to grind from the standpoint that, you know, that's where we talk about why the characters are ranked ordered in the way I put them. That's why I put Mason at the top, because I'm like, wait a minute. Anthony Mason, a guy that was a sixth man the year before that, led the league in minutes. And the game that I'm pretty sure he was pulled out of that he had a problem with, I think he played like 38 minutes in that game and he did not play well. And so that was why, you know, it was like he played plenty. He played plenty that year, played more than anybody that year, but left that note for Don Nelson. And Don Nelson got the note and he's like, what the hell? Like, I'm playing you a ton. and you're still coming at me this way. And it kind of put him in a catch 22 because Don Nelson did not have control over his team that year. He ended up losing his job after 59 games. And so he's just kind of like, you know, I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. If I play the guy this much, he's still complaining.
Is that your favorite Mason story or is there another?
No. There's so many with Mace, man. I mean, I'd have to pick one, but I mean, the next tell pages, this guy tell pages that he gave his boys when they wanted to go out for the night and wanted to, you know, have a fun night out to arrange their plans. But Mason, because he's bought the pagers, having the information that he has and the PIN numbers for them, they would go out and have competitions to see who could get the most women's numbers that night. But Mason had back-end access to the phone, so when his friends got the numbers, he would steal the numbers and then change their voicemail greetings to make them sound gay when the women actually called them. So that story, and then this is probably the one that takes the cake for me. It's in the epilogue. Mace, you remember, you know, the way these camps work, these summer camps where, you know, the team makes a bajillion dollars off of them because they charge a couple hundred dollars a head. And then they have one player come out and maybe sign autographs and just kind of scrimmage with the kids
right.
to make it enjoyable from that standpoint. So Mace is the guy they pick because he's, you know, again, like a sixth man, a bench guy. And that first inaugural, you know, Knicks summer camp, they bring him. He comes out and, you know, they get him a limo. They tell him that they'll pay him $1,500 for appearing. He shows up. The limo pulls up. The kids are thrilled because, it's, you know, there's a player in their midst. But Mason will not get out of the limo. It's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And finally, the administrative director comes out. Ed Tapp's got a guy that would later become their GM. He says, Mace, why haven't you gotten out of the limo? And he says, I'm not getting out. He says, what the hell? Why are you not getting out? We agreed to this. These kids are in here waiting for you. They've seen you at this point. And Mace said, well, that's not really my problem. I'll get out, but you need to make it $2,000 and you need to make it cash today. And Ed Tapp's guy says, like, how am I even supposed to get you that much cash today? Like, I don't know how you guys roll. Dan, you're probably in a different tax bracket than me, but I don't think we can get that much money out of an ATM today. I just don't think it works that way. So anyway, he says, I don't even know how I'm supposed to get that much cash. He's like, again, that's not my problem, but I'm telling you, I'm not getting out of the car for anything less than that.
He's like Aretha Franklin. She distrusted people so much that she demanded that they pay in cash right? because record companies were thieves. Mason is saying, I'm not doing charity unless you give me a handful of cash.
But that's how you do it. You do it when you pull up, okay, and all the kids are waiting yep. and someone's got to go get them the cash.
Leverage.
Right.
Yes, leverage, right? So that's what he says. He says, fine, Mace, like, I'll find a way to do it. Just please come in here. The kids have seen you already. That's the leverage. So Mace gets out with a big smile on his face. He goes in to play with the kids and, you know, watch the kids mostly. But he's scrimmaging with them. And Mace had no ability to turn it off. One time he clotheslined his son the day of his graduation in a game that they're playing 2-11. On the game point, he clotheslined his son to make sure he wouldn't win. But in this moment, in that camp, he ended up inadvertently elbowing a kid in the nose. The kid's nose is broken. He's out cold. And so everybody's freaking out at the camp. The Knicks are petrified of a potential lawsuit. But the kid finally wakes up. He comes to. His nose is crooked. Mace has hovered over him to make sure he's okay. And then the kid smiles and asks Mace if he can have an autograph. So that's the way the camp ends. But then as Mace is getting his payment at the end of it, the one that he's haggled for, if you could even call it that, I guess it's not haggling when you demand it, he then takes the money and says, well, thanks for this. The reason I wanted the extra $500, I'm going to have the limo driver take my mom shopping after I get home. So thanks for this and bye. And, you know, just heads out. And that was kind of the story about how difficult he could be to deal with. He had been with the team for 1 year and by no means was he like a star at this point. He had not accomplished much, but he was just a difficult, difficult guy to deal with. But a guy that most guys came to love at a certain point.
Pat Riley once ejected him or suspended him, and he ended up being during a practice or something in the audience of the Ricky Lake show where he was supposed to be someplace else. Who were the greatest clashers on that team? Because Pat Riley's style was confrontational and aggressive, and that team was confrontational and aggressive.
Yeah, no, I can't think of anybody that Riley kind of got into it more than Mace. He suspended him twice, actually, both at the end of the season. The first time, the suspension was kind of so polarizing for everybody because it was right before the playoffs started and Pat was going to leave him off the playoff roster until essentially Pat's two bosses, Ernie Grunfeld and Dave Checkets, stepped in and said, you can't leave this guy off the playoff roster because we're going to get smoked. He's our best versatile, like all-around player. He's probably our best guy. So I don't even think it's a question that it was those two. There was, though, I'll say that there was a clash that I make a point of making a little bit of a bigger deal about. mostly because the players did. 94, we all know about John Starks going 2-for-18 in that finals, game 7 in 94 against the Rockets. And there was one instance in which Pat, 2.5 weeks before that game, had kind of gotten into it a little bit with Rolando Blackman, a guy that had mostly out of the rotation. But, you know, for people that don't know it, to this day, I think he's second all-time in Mavericks scoring history. Dirk is the only guy that's outscored him. So at this time, he was the leading scorer in Mavs history. He was a guy that played most of his career with the Mavs, who had just dominated the Rockets throughout his career, and that the Rockets were petrified of him. He and Pat had a disagreement where Rolando basically asked him right after that Pacers win that put the Knicks in the finals, and none of these Knicks players had ever won a championship before. I don't think any of them had been to the finals before. Rolando asked Pat in front of the whole team, can we bring our wives to Houston for, you know, for the beginning of the series? Pat says no. And again, Pat is someone that is very much in or out, down to even, as I said before, the color of what your car is. So then Rolando says, I don't understand, Pat. You know, and Rolando's a respected veteran on this team. He says, our wives have held down our households all year. None of us have ever accomplished anything like this before. This is a huge moment for us. We want to share it with them. Are you really telling me we can't bring our wives? And Pat, again, just left it as a no. Like, he didn't really explain. He said they're a distraction, and he left it at that. But the players were all kind of taken aback at the fact that not only Pat was very rarely challenged like that, certainly in front of a group, but two, that Pat was kind of so short with Rolando. So Rolando didn't play at all during the finals. Again, he wasn't a big, big rotation guy. He got minutes here and there. But when John shoots 2-for-18 and everybody's looking around for who he could possibly replace Starks with, Rolando is the first guy the Rockets are concerned about, but Rolando never got off the bench. And everybody from Rolando himself to Doc to Charles Oakley's got a book coming out in a couple of weeks, and he mentions this detail as well. Derek Harper, all of them are of the opinion that that might have played a role in why Pat didn't use Rolando Blackman in the series. And to that point, Pat has called it, you know, if not the biggest mistake, one of the biggest mistakes in his career. And he's written letters to Rolando over the years, handwritten letters that, you know, I'm not sure if you would call them outright apologies, but Rolando has said that he's never taken the time to write back to Pat. So they clashed over that. I don't think it was the biggest clash Pat ever had. I think those were with Mason, but that was one that I do think had a role in something much bigger later on.
Fat Joe says that Biggie Smalls, I got a story to tell, that that's about Anthony Mason. Did you get to the bottom of that? Did you find those details?
I tried. And Dan, I love you, man. I've been saying this to people. First of all, before I answer it completely, I will say I want people to fully appreciate how challenging a question that is to ask. Because on the one hand, you could ask Mace's boys, who Mace's boys confided in me that, like, Mace slept with some of the wives of his teammates, which I think is a pretty big reveal, multiple teammates. But I want people to fully appreciate the, like, to potentially get to the complete and whole truth of this, that you can't really rely on Mace's boys. You have to ask the women that Mace was with, basically, like, did you have Biggie hide in the closet, more or less? What were you screwing around on Anthony? So it's a difficult question to ask, which I did. I did ask them. Each of them said no. I did ask Mace's boys, because Mace obviously was bragging about sleeping with the wives of teammates. So, you know, naturally he would have told them about this. Maybe it's not something you're as proud of, but you would probably tell them about this if you were willing to tell them about the other stuff. And a couple people told me yes, but the people that I trusted most told me he never told me that, and he would have told me that. So I don't think it was him, honestly, but I could be wrong on that. But I certainly asked, even down to the women, which, like I said, someone that he was essentially, that he was engaged to. I asked her and other people. So hopefully people can realize that it's a really awkward thing to ask, but I did ask and I never got a clear sense. And I don't think it happened, but I never got a clear sense.
What kind of problems did Mace sleeping with teammates' wives cause?
I never got to the bottom of that. I'm also not sure that they knew. I didn't make the point of naming who these people were, just because, you know, in some cases, you're talking about current stuff. And so it's not, I didn't see a need to do it, but I don't think it was out there. And if it was, it certainly wasn't something that I heard about. So I got the impression very clearly that it was not out there previously and still is not out there.
New book, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 90s New York Knicks, is available now. He did it exhaustively. It is a ton of sources and it's a bunch of questions. Chris, thank you so much for making the time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Chris.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text SUNNY to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text SUNNY to 200-300. That's SUNNY to 200-300. SUNNY to 200-300.